here, it's not necessarily true that the law of that the principle of Rodef or whatever other principle guided Rabbi Feinstein in his ruling would apply. We had a number of other situations, but in each situation, these are the types of questions you have to ask. You would have to present the rabbi or the halachic authority, number one, with the prognosis, the medical prognosis, for what's going to happen if they're going to be left together, or what's going to be happen if they're separated. And obviously we can only rely on the most, on the best available prognosis, diagnosis, if you wish. And then, each question, each case can be taken by its own merit. Before I take questions, because I do want to be able to address more what people want me to focus upon, I will finish off with this second dilemma that was involved in the Manchester case, and I presume in many other cases, the question of who has the right to make a decision. And the reason I want to focus on this is because I think that this actually expresses a fundamental axiom of Jewish medical ethics. I always, ever since I got into this area of discipline of medical ethics, Jewish medical ethics in specific, I was always looking for some sort of guiding principle, something that could be seen as the spinal cord of Jewish medical ethics. Obviously, here, there's always differences. One opinion says this, one opinion says that. Different denominations have different traditions. And of course there may be parallels to this in other traditions. But what I believe is at the root of the difference between Jewish medical ethics and Western ethics, in the more the broader sense of the word, is that in Western ethics the key word today, which is the buzzword in any commissions, meetings and analysis, is autonomy. That is the key word. The autonomy of the individual, and the problems related when the individual is incompetent and he can't exercise his autonomous rights. So who steps in? As, for example, in the case that we've been reading about for the last week, in England not so much, but when I come to America, or here Canada, but on the way in Boston as well, I see that the papers talk about nothing else other than it. Who had the right to make a decision? Who represents, if you wish, the autonomy of the patient? Who is the agent that now personifies the patient's wish? In Jewish law, we don't speak so much about autonomy. Jewish medical ethics don't speak about so much about rights, privileges. Jewish medical ethics speaks about duty and obligation. For example, let us take the question of suicide. It is even accepted in modern society that if a person is trying to commit suicide, we stop him. Yeah, a person wants to throw himself off the Brooklyn Bridge, and the ambulances and the police and everyone else is summoned, even psychologists sometimes, and they try and convince them not to do it. Even this is not always happening, but it's a possibility. But this is usually because we say the person is deranged, he's clinically depressed, he's suffering from some condition that he is not capable of knowing what his own autonomous desire is. What happens if he would have been lying in a bed in hospital and he says that he wants to commit suicide because he's suffering from chronic pain for the last 3 years and has been examined by two eminent psychologists who confirm that he is making this decision in sound mind and in tranquil state of being? Then more and more countries and states are beginning to accept that the person has the right to commit suicide. In Jewish law, the person does not have a right to commit suicide. Why not? Why does Jewish law speak about duties? What do you mean? A person says, look, I want to die. Now, earlier ethicists who discussed this talking, going back to the days of Hume and so on, and Kant and the early sort of the fathers of Western philosophy as we have it today, would speak about, would try and find some sort of crime to society. The person who commits suicide is harming the family, is harming the community. He's doing something for society. But what happens if there's nothing wrong with the society? He's not losing out at all. The person's in hospital, he's got no relatives, no one wants him to live. On the contrary, his relatives want him to die because there's £100,000 or dollars in the bank and it's going down every day. And if the person commits suicide, then there'll be more, you know, to invest in the new villa in the south of France or whatever else you want to do with it. The reason, well, Jewish law, and this is my final point in my presentation, relates to this, it relates to Siamese twins, it relates to all these situations. Jewish law does not consider a person to be the ultimate owner of his life. Jewish law considers a person to be no more than a custodian who has been charged with the duty of looking after that life. My neighbor went on holiday for a few weeks. So she said, "Do you mind to look after the cat?" So I thought, no, she told me, you just open in the morning a tin of food and a bit of milk and it eats it, goes out to play and it comes back. I left it and thought nothing like that happened. The wallpaper was scratched. Then it started scraping the side of the table. It was making funny noises all day. It was driving me mashuga. I wanted to get rid of the cat. I couldn't cope with this cat anymore. But I'd undertaken to be a custodian for the cat. So I made sure to call Tenerife and get, you know, the woman on the phone. I said, "Look, you know, it's either my sanity or this cat. Give me permission to take it to some kennel or whatever they put cats in. I can't cope with the cat." But I would not have had the right to have just taken the cat and sold it or given it as a present to some cat lover. Why not? Because the cat is not mine to give away. I can ask the owner to take it back or to, but I can't terminate the cat's life or send it, sell it, or give it away of my own accord. In Judaism, the same is true about our own lives. Never mind the lives of our children and the lives of our loved ones. We were entrusted with our bodies, with our lives, to use them, to foster them, to look after them, and keep them in the best possible condition that we can. Judaism does not always insist on heroics at the end of life stages, but certainly to do something to terminate life or to withdraw that which is holding life, nutrition and hydration, unless there is some extraordinary circumstances, is forbidden. Not because of any slippery slope syndrome arguments, not because of any damage to society, but for one reason. The verse, the prophet Ezekiel said, chapter 18, verse 6, "Hanafroshos liheno," the souls, God says, belong to me.
If anybody has any questions for any of the speakers, now's the time. We have about 15 minutes, so any questions for any of the speakers? Yeah.
Many years ago, over 50 years ago, when I just graduated from the University of Toronto in medicine, I went back to Ottawa Pacific as the only young girl to intern. The following year, at one point, I went into bacteriology. And the question came up when my chief told me that when he, I had gone to McGill at that point to be trained, that when he was young, and he was already nearly retired then, and diphtheria toxin, antitoxin first came into being. There wasn't enough to give to everybody, particularly in some of our eastern provinces. And the family had to decide which of the children were going to be inoculated. Should they give it to the stronger ones who are more likely to survive? Or because they're stronger, will they more likely survive and therefore give it to the weaker ones? I would be interested in your comments on that.
The lady here has asked a question about a problem that's known in the medical vernacular as triage, where you have a situation of limited resources. Not so different, perhaps, than some of the cases we spoke about tonight, limited limbs. But triage, in the normal sense, the case that the lady was speaking about was where you had a limited amount of vaccination to be used for the inoculation against, for the immunization against disease. Who comes first? The truth is that there are very few guidelines in Jewish law for this. The general principle is, first come, first served. If there is a situation of a life which is in danger and a life which is not in danger, then the life which is in danger comes first. But other than that, there is very little, and the simple reason is also because usually there is someone who comes first. When a doctor walks into a ward, there is a patient there. He doesn't need to go to the furthest bed or examine all the patients and decide which one is older, stronger. There is a process of first come. And the reason for this is because we cannot benefit one over the other. In the very limited situations where there is a choice, that means there is a doctor, a physician, a paramedic, a lifeguard is summoned on the scene where there is, let's say there's two people swimming in a pool. Say I was swimming in a pool together with Rabbi Kelman, and we were both about to drown. And there was a lifeguard there, or someone who could jump in and save us. And he saw us simultaneously. And the question was, who? Here there are some guidelines, but I should preface my comments by saying that in most cases it would be a matter of discretion. The person would just have to take a pick. However, there are some guidelines. For example, if the lifeguard happened to be Rabbi Kelman's son, then his first duty would be to his father, for example. There are certain hierarchical considerations that the Mishnah actually provides, which will sound very strange to Western ears, but for the sake of authenticity, I feel obliged to say them, and that is that there is, you have the precedence of a Kohen to a Levi and a Levi to an Israelite. So are you a Kohen or a Levi? No. But if we could speculate, I'm not a Kohen either. Right. If Rabbi Kelman was either a Kohen or a Levi, since I'm only an ordinary Israelite, his life would come first. Now this hardly smacks of egalitarianism at its best. But this is the Talmudic law. And in theory, although very rarely would come into practice, would actually be the Jewish law. I must add, though, that in order for this, it shouldn't be as strange as it looks, as it sounds, because in order for this law precedence to obtain, you would have to be dealing with a case where all odds are equal. Where, from a secular point of view, you would just say, take your pick. In other words, the precedence of the Kohen over the Levi, or the Levi over the Yisrael, obtains in situations where there is no other halachic stroke ethical reason to prioritize one over the other. If there was, then of course this wouldn't take place. This wouldn't be of a consideration. It is also said that if you have two people drowning, for example, and one of them is a person who is a great benefit to the community, a philanthropist, an educator, someone who the community needs, and the other isn't, then again, provided that all odds are equal, the person who is intrinsically, who is critical to the needs of the community, comes first. But this is never, this is always in a situation of triage and limited resources before they've been administered. Let me explain what I mean by an example. In situations which, let's say two patients were brought into hospital and there was only one respirator and you could give it to one or to the other, right? You're talking about an emergency section, accident, people were brought in from a car crash, and an old man came in and he's in his 90s and he's suffering from heart condition and he's obviously not going to live very much longer anyway, yes? And he takes the first respirator. And then a young man of 18 comes in, who's got his whole life ahead of him, and his girlfriend is waiting outside and she's in absolute state. And this old man says, give him the respirator, give him the respirator. The principle that I enunciated before, Ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh obtains. We do not take the respirator away from the person who has got it. Because that would basically mean kill the older man in order to save the younger man. The justification to do so would be on the grounds that the older man only has 3 years to live, whereas the younger man has 63 years left to live. And therefore 63 is more than 3. But that is giving life, that is trying to determine the value of life, which is a concept which is generally speaking alien to Judaism. So the whole spectrum where the laws of triage apply are extremely limited in Jewish law, because they would never allow the removal of an appliance, a medication, or a tool from a lesser member of society to, say, a more important person, even a high priest. It would only be a question before it's been given, and there's limited resources, and you've got to make an instantaneous decision. So it does remain more or less in the realm of theory than, rather than practice. Yes, I don't want to monopolize this session. I believe.
I'm just curious, from on a medical point of view, how you deal with that?
Did everybody hear the question?
Sorry.
The question was, how do we justify or how do we deal with the issue of spending upwards of $250,000 on separating a set of twins from Zimbabwe when there are people dying on waiting lists in Ontario? Is that basically? And that's, I mean, my answer to that is that's why we have the Herbie Fund. I mean, this is, the hospital has struggled with this question. I mean, we want to save every child's life. We want to make every child's life as good as we can in the world. But we can't do that. We don't have the resources to do that. So the hospital has made it very clear that Ontario patients and Canadian patients come first, and they get the priority dollars. But the Herbie Fund was set up through separate funding mechanisms. The Herbie Fund is not funded by the Ministry of Health. It's not funded by our tax dollars. It's funded by you and I and everybody else who gives voluntarily to the Herbie Fund for this purpose. And there are several additional benefits to having children come that serve the ultimate purpose of making children's lives better around the world. One is the educational function that we serve at the hospital. So by bringing a set of conjoined twins here and separating them, we are actually training a wide range of specialists, many of whom are training at our hospital and are going to go back to developing countries. And ultimately, through this process, we'll allow them to save many more lives in their own countries than we would save here.
If I can ask a follow-up, you know, in the papers for the last week,
as a follow-up, the case in the papers on the person who wants to donate a kidney, and the Royal Hospital of Montreal won't accept the kidney. So how does that compare sort of to, like, quote-unquote, like a separate fund? We don't have anybody in Canada. Here we have an outsider who's willing to donate, and the hospital said they won't do it because they're afraid either of money passing hands or whatever it is, of jumping lists. I'm just curious if, from a medical point of view, you see a distinction in the two cases. Do you follow what I'm saying? Yeah.
Well, I think with the kidney case, I don't think is an issue of somebody jumping a list. I think it's an issue of paying money to somebody to donate an organ, which is something that is against the law.
Right. So my understanding is that's not the only issue, because they were willing to sign an affidavit that there was no money if the hospital then said they have to wait their turn. So, in other words, because this is the exact same issue, it's an outsider, another country, someone is quote-unquote paying for it with their own kidney instead of cash, and there we say it's a terrible thing, and I agree this is a wonderful thing. I was extremely moved by the whole presentation. Really, it's beautiful. But there still is that issue that here the outsiders are good and there the outsiders are not good, and I'm curious why that's so medically or... sorry.
Previous one. I just want to add one point to the question that Rabbi Kalman asked about allocating so much funds for twins in Zimbabwe. Obviously, this goes across the board. I mean, we're always, the question of allocation of funds to pet charities. For example, we question the people who invest in animal welfare rather than investing in human welfare, which is a fair point. I'm not making a decisive comment here. I'm just want to contribute two ideas. Number one, the fact that certain people, I very much believe in divine providence, the fact that certain people encounter specific causes and are moved, to use my expression before, adopt and develop a love for that particular cause, can also be an indication from heaven, so to speak, that that's where they ought to invest their energy. And we all have to be guided by that, because otherwise life, whatever we do in life, whatever good we do in life, we could always say, well, why are we doing this? Why are we not doing something else? The other point is that there is actually a universal message in this whole episode. In a time where polarization and sort of one country against another, one race against another, is unfortunately on the increase. The idea that Americans make this effort for people in Africa, the idea that Jewish people serve as a light unto the nations by showing that we are ready to make these type of efforts for people who we've never seen, we don't have any common heritage for, is not just a question of spending $200,000 for these particular twins. I would say it is an investment into the moral fabric of society, and it's specifically into the role of the Jewish nation in reinvigorating universal ethics.
I'll just respond with one other very quick comment to that, and I think that for me, when you're doing work in places where people don't have the resources that we do, ultimately I think the goal is to improve the setting where they are. There was not a patient that I saw in my time abroad that I would not have liked to have been able to bring here and do for as would be routine care in this country. But you can't do that for a population of thousands and thousands or millions of people. This was one tangible case. So I think as much as we have to work on one tangible case to do what we can, we have to work to improve the health care in the countries where these people are and to bring up the standard of care in their locations to what we enjoy here.
Should we have some questions?
No.
Okay. I'll do our closing ceremonies. I'll, you know what? It's late. Okay, Shatter hands up. Last question, and then we'll do it privately.
I was just going to say what they said. Basically what I was going to say, that no matter what you do, there's always going to be something that'll say, well, why did we do that? And I mean, I think what they did was wonderful. And the fact, I was going to say that you were there when you were there, maybe that is divine providence, that you should have been there and this should have happened. And with all the bad things going on in the world the way they are now, I mean, this is a good thing. And I don't know, it's just a statement, it's not a question. There's always going to be something wrong. There's always going to be a question and a dilemma, and everybody's probably thinking, why is she talking so long? But there's, you know, it's too much good stuff like this to, it's a good thing. Lots of bad stuff.
Hi, I'm going to close up the program, but if anyone has some more questions, our speakers will be around for a few minutes and can ask them. I just want to say that I think, to me, this is like one of the most inspiring sessions I've ever been to, and we're so privileged to have people like Dr. Spitzer and Dr. Langer in our community who really reflect so wonderfully on all of us and really are, as Rabbi Rappaport said, reflect the Jewish people as a light unto the nations with this fantastic word. So I want to thank all the speakers very, very much for coming. I want to thank all of you for coming. We have some gifts for the speakers, which they've got your names on it. For shortage of time, I'm not going to give them to each of you, but wonderful gifts, including a free Tim Pass to all of our programs in the next year, so you'll hope to come. And please, everybody, there are evaluations. I don't know if you got them, but it's extremely important for us that you fill in the evaluations because it helps us to put on programs like this. So thank you very much to everyone for coming and to our speakers. Thank you.